It is Saturday, April 10th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, and the second half, your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now for, what is the show name? I believe it's Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Geek Speak is copyright Creative Commons, share and share alike. If you'd like to use our content for nonprofit purposes, please feel free to do so. If you'd like to participate in the show by adding theme music, creating your own theme music, or image art for our website, let us know at geekspeak.org. Today's theme music was by Al Luckow. Join the car guys, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, for their advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk every Saturday right after Geek Speak at 11 on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks today are Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow, and Miles Elam. Good morning, geeks.
Good morning.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, hello.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. My name is Lyle Troxell, and we're going to start the show off today with the geek news because it is a special week in tech. Is it a week or a month? It's a week.
Week.
Go ahead.
It's
Al.
Both, actually.
It's a special week. It's it's the National Robotics Week 2010 from April 10th to
which
the
is
18th.
Today.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yes, April 10th to the 18th.
What does that mean? You have to love your robot?
Well, basically, all sorts of robotic things. The purpose of the week is to celebrate the U.S. as a leader in robotics technology development, which I sort of question, given how many things come out of Japan, at least things that are kind of worth, talking about. And to educate the public about robotics technology and how it impacts society. Mm-hmm. And advocate for increased funding for robotics technology research and development, and to inspire students of all ages to pursue careers in robotics and other science, technology, engineering, and math-related fields.
Be a geek.
Yes, yeah, basically.
Good. Good. Yeah. I like. Well, since it's the week of robotics, you got a robot story?
Oh, yes. I have many robot stories. I think I will start out with the one that where there's a Spanish bank that has decided it's really big, and they have they've decided to get robots to help people find their way around. And these robots are they're like little red. They're actually very cool looking, zippy little. They look like little VWs, but kind of narrower. And they help people get around in the you kind of tell it what you want, where you want it to go, if you want to go to a conference room or whatever. And it just sort of, it's like a little dog, and you just sort of follow the thing around. And that's it's actually pretty good use. I guess the company has like 9 buildings and 5,000 employees. So
so it's necessary to have that much information. And they don't want to make a strip on the wall. You can just come up and touch and talk like in Star Trek.
Well, they have they're talking. This is swarm robots is what they call it. Mm-hmm. And which I don't know that it really fits that description, but they have all these robots, and you can go to this group, and then one of them comes up, says, may I help you, or whatever, right, whatever it is in Spanish. And so then you just sort of tell it where you want it to go, and you also choose, there's a touch screen, it lets you choose what language you want to speak. Mm-hmm. And then it will bring you
to the place,
wherever you want to go.
That travels with you,
basically. Yeah. Cool. This is in Madrid, and it's apparently a very big bank. Mm-hmm. And they're actually kind of cute. I mean, it just seems like a neat use of robots.
Yeah, interaction, human interaction is always a fun one for robots.
Do its wheels lock up when you leave the bank?
So right. It doesn't. Yeah.
So you can't take it with you?
Yeah.
I need to go to my house.
I'll take you there.
Yeah. And I thought at first when I saw them, they were just showing pictures of them. I thought, you get in those things? Because it looks like you could kind of get in them. But they're pretty small. when you see them next to a person, oh, it only comes up to your knee, you know.
Can you put your bag on it, though?
I'm sure that would be a good idea.
That's nice. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Carry your bag yourself.
Geeky Games, Ben?
Geeky Games, yeah. So do any of you guys have any guesses as to the longest standing record in gaming history? What game?
How long a game has been played or how well it's been played?
The longest standing record. So someone makes a record and then no one beats it for a really long time.
I'm going to go with 27 years. Miles?
Well, no, which game?
I'm going to go with Donkey Kong.
See, you already I've know, actually probably, read the yeah. article, so You've I guess I'd be well, cheating if I said cheat. It.
Yeah. How about you, Al? Do you have any guesses?
I would say... Since it's a long-standing thing, it has to be an old game.
And that's it has true. To also be something that's
something's
complex
been,
or...
Been around.
Yeah.
I think... And something people that get obsessed with. So my guess
Space
would have
Invaders,
to be...
Space Invaders, Pac-Man.
There's Galaga, Robotron.
Galaga's a good one. Yeah. Right.
I would say Galaga.
All right.
So it's actually Asteroids.
Oh, really? Oh,
Asteroids is the longest-standing record. It was... The record was set November 14th, 1982
okay.
by a 15-year-old kid, Scott Safran. He stayed awake for 3 days...
Playing the
whole and
time.
He played, and he got a high score of 41,336,440 points. Now, you said that it has to be a complex game. Actually, the article I'm reading from, actually, a Wired article, has this really funny sentence in it. It says, "Once you master the basics, Asteroid is simply a game of endurance. Can you keep from falling asleep? And if you can... Will the arcade cabinet you're playing on stay glitch-free and powered up for 3 days straight?" So really, those are the variables that you're worried about. So anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up is because...
Does that game not get more complicated every level?
I don't think it does, or maybe it just...
It gets faster, I don't know.
Yeah, well...
There's got to be a point where
it
just
stops getting faster.
Stops getting faster, yeah.
Well, there are limits of the CPU, though. The
graphics
processor. But if it was only locked down by the CPU, I guess the traditional game would lock it down, but a new game wouldn't.
At that time, that's how they made games harder. They just made them go faster.
Right, but the guy played it on the original console.
There's lots of ways to make Asteroids harder. I mean, of course, they're robots.
More aliens.
More aliens, more Asteroids per level. If you just keep on increasing Asteroids per level,
this flying saucer that comes through and tries to shoot you
down.
Two
or three of them per second.
The reason I'm bringing it up is that John McAllister sat down at a friend's house in Portland, Oregon on Saturday, probably about the same time we were recording Geek Speak, and he was still playing on Monday. And he actually beat, at 10:18 p.m., he beat the score with 41,338,000. That's instead of 336,000. 740. It was recorded. It was broadcast on Justin TV, streamed live.
Cool.
So you can watch it.
Was it a cabinet game?
It was a cabinet. It was the original, yeah. And the other sentence I'd like to read from this article is, "Every few hours, once he had racked up enough extra lives, McAllister got up from his bar stool, paced the room, ate a sandwich, and then sat back down to play."
So he's letting himself die.
A last-minute bathroom break Monday evening almost cost McAllister the title. He got down to only two ships before rallying back. So, and then eventually, I didn't actually watch.
That'd be
this,
the way to do it. Just be really excellent at it and get up 10 guys and then go into the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly.
I was actually thinking colostomy bag, but
that's like an astronaut. That's not fair, actually. That wouldn't be fair if you had a colostomy bag.
Yeah, that's not fair.
Or if you could do power naps. You know,
that's actually the guy that's in the ship that you're controlling. He's got a colostomy bag in the spaceship. You know, because that's. All right, moving on.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that. So. Thanks, Ben.
Yes.
Miles, this is more of a topic thing. What's going on with, WikiLeaks? Tell me about it.
Okay, this has come up in the news a lot. It's been covered a lot. But I wanted to take a geek angle on the fact that you have a site called WikiLeaks that is providing information, basically leaks, the information that people don't want out there. And it does raise questions with regard to WikiLeaks. Like, they're not in U.S. jurisdiction, so do our laws apply to them?
The basic idea is if I found out something at my job or in government or something that I felt was inappropriate, I could take the documentation and everything and put it up on this wiki, and then the wiki would keep it perpetually available to people. So my leaked information, like inappropriate expenses for funds and stuff, couldn't be hidden from the public view. That's the basic idea of WikiLeaks. Right.
And
couldn't you just do that on Wikipedia?
that's the thing, though. A lot of things will be taken down. Wikipedia is governed by U.S. law.
Okay.
It is within U.S. jurisdiction, or at least the English language one is. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the others. But I think of if you go to the average U.S. citizen and you say Tiananmen Square, do you think that the video and the information regarding the Tiananmen Square massacre should be available to the Chinese citizens?
I would say yes, personally.
If you walk to someone up on the street, chances are they would say yes. They would say yes. People should have access to the information to know what their government is doing. And so this comes up with this video of an Apache helicopter that is firing upon a group of people, including two Reuters journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And in watching the video, I don't have a strong opinion about it. It is difficult to watch.
It's horrible. It's war.
Right.
People die.
I don't necessarily think that the Apache helicopter pilots were absolutely in the wrong, and they do have a lot of gallows humor, but at the same time, I don't know of any war that doesn't.
Right. Meaning that they're finding humor in the situation even though they're killing people.
Right. But what
Which is a coping mechanism to some degree, and we can get into that, but we're not a psychology show, so we won't.
Right. But I do have an issue that they put up a Freedom of Information Act, or Reuters put up a Freedom of Information Act request to find out about them, and it was denied. And so then you have this outlet.
Reuters reporters were killed in this incident, right? And so Reuters knew that the Apache helicopter that did this has video footage so that they can do training missions. They can keep track of what they did. They have really good documentation of the work they do in war now. And so Reuters said, hey, we'd like a copy of this Freedom of Information. Give it to us. U.S. government said no, that would be...
The Pentagon said no.
Said no, that would be probably...
It's a state secret.
Secret.
It's classified.
Some sort. And then what happened?
And so then someone inside the Department of Defense leaked the video to WikiLeaks.
Got a copy somehow and got the video up to WikiLeaks.
Right. Or actually it's encrypted information, so someone had to also have the keys to it. But they released it and it was edited and then shown for people like with arrows and circles and, mm-hmm. and the like. And I'm not saying that WikiLeaks is neutral. I mean, they named the video Collateral Murder. So it's
not neutral.
Yeah, they're not neutral. But at the same time, there is a case for the Pentagon should have honored that freedom. I don't see any reason why the Pentagon should not have honored the Freedom of Information Act request from it.
I see what you're saying. I mean, that's the difficult thing is that state secrets would be like, let's say the video footage showed a weapon that no one knows how it works.
Right.
And even the distance, maybe even knowing the distance.
I watched this video too, and the thing that was really amazing was how far away that helicopter must have been, because the people didn't even know it was there. And helicopters allowed.
Right, the helicopter was multiple kilometers away, so they couldn't even have heard it.
They didn't even hear the thing, and so maybe that was secret. But you were saying that I would think that, well, if you post that, you're going to get in trouble, but you were saying that this WikiLeaks is located somewhere else?
Well, it's not within U.S. jurisdiction. In fact, if they knew where it was, they probably would try to take them out.
And the U.S. doesn't filter their internet traffic to be able to close that port down to U.S. citizens. So right now you can go and watch this video.
Right.
So that's interesting.
And in fact,
China,
it's gone viral. Like people keep uploading copies to it to YouTube.
Everywhere.
So even if you do have takedown requests, it shows up.
That's one of the things about trying to share information, trying to hide information in this age. There's really no good way to do it. I mean, if you want to put something up and people want to see it, there's going to be copies in moments and then they repost.
Right. And that's what I wanted to bring up. I don't want to turn
into the
democracy
political
now
aspect
per se. It's more of, it is political. It's just the politics of hosting a server that displays information that people in power don't like, and what protection should be afforded to them.
Well, what protection can you afford them? You can't. I mean, the governments that don't want it to be shown will start trying to take it down and fight it. I mean, what
contrary,
are you asking? Like, if you were a person that was hosting this kind of content?
On the contrary, if for U.S. citizens, you have things like the Bill of Rights. There's mm-hmm. a legal recourse there. But for someone like WikiLeaks, I mean, to post information that the Pentagon didn't want released, at least for as regard to U.S. law, there is no recourse for them.
Right.
There is no
Let me ask you this. Do you think – I mean, Al, your perspective was if it was inappropriate enough, it would be taken down. It doesn't really matter.
I would think that it being a government thing, even in the U.S., it would be considered a leak and, they would – go after. I mean, obviously, there's a trail to who leaked it. I mean, it's very risky to do any of that stuff, and I would think it'd be taken down. But I think Miles' point is,
it's
the internet.
It's not possible necessarily.
Nowadays, something gets out, it's over. There's
And this is, I think, a different scale, or a yeah, it's a different scale of thing than the Tiananmen Square massacre. But like I said, if you ask someone randomly on the street in the U.S. and say, how do you think the Tiananmen Square massacre should China's request for people to not display information on it be honored worldwide or honored within China, and you would have people go like, what? No, this is something we need to know
about. This just comes down to a political thing. I mean, I don't want to say enemies, but people that don't necessarily like the situation the United States is in, being a world power and in multiple aggressive fronts.
And anybody, we have control over the internet and giving out IP addresses.
Would be happy to have – yeah, that's true. Any of those governments would be happy to put that content up, right? So there's going to be support – because it's a political document, there's going to be support from others to put it up. But this question about what the U.S. could do if it really wanted to, it could take that thing down. I mean, network traffic goes through the U.S. You can pretty much – internet – traffic could be affected pretty easily by the U.S. military.
Anything that goes through the U.S.
Well, let's just put, just take the big telcos. They would get hit hard if they had a takedown notice of some sort from the federal government. I would assume that it would be able to be taken down.
Except the telcos don't know the individual ones. That means that you would need to also take down all of YouTube. You need to take down all of Vimeo. You need to take down every site that does video, and then try to police every person that decides to put that video up onto their own personal site as a copy.
It would be hard.
It really is like peeing in the pool.
Yeah, it would really be hard to get rid of. I think that if you tried very effectively, you could do it. I think that there's enough video detection software. You could look at a few frames and fingerprint it and look at every new video that came up to YouTube and take it down within a few minutes.
What if someone takes down the video and re-encodes it in a different codec?
Even in a different codec, you actually come back out to the frames. You can look at the frames and do detection. You have a lot of positive misses, but you could do it.
That's
even if
a tremendous add colorization and you start like
battle, but I think if Google was on it, they could do it.
There's some amazing technology out there, but that would be a tremendous technical undertaking, and it would take up tons of CPU. I mean, you'd be filtering any video content that goes anywhere.
Let's put it this perspective. Has anybody here seen like naked breasts on YouTube?
Yes.
You have? Was it up after a few minutes?
No.
Right.
People have told me about it. People flagging content.
No comment.
Right.
But still, that still is a pretty effective way of squelching content. That content just isn't up.
Yeah, but that's not the video fingerprinting kind of technology.
You're thinking that people wouldn't fingerprint it?
No, I don't think that people would report it, especially if it wasn't on a site with a built-in reporting mechanism like YouTube.
Well, let me ask you this. If Google came out and said, you know what, on YouTube, you can't have any war footage, U.S. war footage. We won't allow it. And if you're doing that, you're out of breach. And they ask their users to start filtering. Will the users do it?
Okay, but even if they did, that's still not addressing the
that's technical of not doing it that way, of doing it with CPU detection.
Yeah, and also having it not on video sites. I mean, there are so many different ways of getting video up online.
That's true.
You know?
And you've also brought up an interesting question of, do technology companies either have a right responsibility or the like to follow along with the party line of government officials?
They're government contracted entities, right? They exist because
the government chartered entities.
Chartered entities. They exist because the government says they can exist. Now, corporations that are large enough are multi-governmental, then they could potentially ignore, requests. But it wouldn't be that hard for Congress to say, no more footage of the U.S. war at all. You can't have any soldiers on. That passes. What is Google going to do?
It makes you wonder how much control is out there. Because
I feel like it's just a few steps away from that kind of thing, and I feel like it's always that way.
Well, Google pulled out of China and rerouted all their traffic to Hong Kong. So the question of what Google would do is they probably would comply because it's the U.S. market, but
I'm sorry, I kind of cut you off. What'd you say?
Well, it's just, when you it used to be, years ago, a government or whoever could come in and shut down the presses. You had one point of failure. And now with the internet, things are so spread out in such a vascular way that there may be no control actually anymore. There may be no way to stop, you can't stop the bad stuff or the good stuff. So, essentially somebody could be.
I've mentioned Cory Doctorow before. Cory Doctorow is an author, really great books. He talks in this realm a lot, his content. He's also a big believer in electronic freedom and part of the EFF founders. Mm-hmm. And his perspective is that any technology actually favors the disruptive influence, not the stable influence, right? So when the printing press came about, sure, a government could come in and turn off that one press, but there were multiple presses, so it was still hard to do. Mm-hmm. And now it is technically very difficult for the government to censure something effectively. Like, look at the Great Wall of China.
It's easy to censure, hard to censor.
Yes, true. Hard to effectively censor, but easy to censure. And that's just the case. Like, it's pretty easy to get the content out there, and it would take a lot of effort to fight it. The thing is, I think the ability is there to pretty effectively get rid of this video. If it was a highly desirable thing from the U.S. government, I think they could do it.
I would disagree for another reason, which is
that pushback would be the thing that would be interesting.
Yeah, I would disagree for another reason, which is that we've only been talking about HTTP traffic. I mean, we've got BitTorrent, we've got all those different ways.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, with that, you wouldn't be able to use a solution like video fingerprinting.
Well, let me put it this way. If there was a situation where a video footage came out that the U.S. Citizenry really didn't want up and was, like, highly offended by it and wanted it down, and therefore Congress had the support from the U.S. citizens, then some pretty horrible things could have happened from that. BitTorrent just being turned off completely on the internet.
Yeah,
which is it really would be really easy. Five telcos would have to say no more BitTorrent traffic, and it's gone. And then we'd have to come up with another way of doing this. But you want to wrap it up, Miles?
Yeah, I wanted to have the conversation.
Uh-huh.
But there's also other news. I want to give other folks a chance.
Yeah, I know the other news you want to talk about.
No. There's other news that the other guys have.
All right.
As well.
Well, thank you very much, Miles, for the interesting thing on WikiLeaks. I don't think I'm going to watch the video. Al, would you recommend watching this?
I wouldn't recommend it. No, I mean, just to know that it's there and that, you know, I mean, it's not something.
It's U.S. soldiers in an Apache helicopter talking about how they're going to get the guys. And
yeah.
Oh yeah, we got them, and things are blowing up, and people are dying. Yeah,
it's not a good thing.
Okay, so if you're into that kind of thing, go ahead and watch it, but I would recommend not, and I'm not going to. And Al, it's your turn.
Oh.
So what's going on with keyboards?
Oh, yes. Back to a more lighthearted subject, rubber keyboards.
Yay!
Rubber keyboards.
You feel good on your fingers. What do you mean, rubber keyboards?
Well,
that's
you
not
know,
possible.
Something about this thing, I ran across this.
Is this a USB of the week?
It's no, but it is a USB device, mm-hmm. and the USB is really the crazy USB,
right.
So it's usually some useless thing.
Which, this isn't useless.
This is not, there's a picture of it. It's on a UK, it's geekstore.co.nz, it's a UK.
Yeah, up on geekspeak.org.
Yeah, probably. It's on geekspeak.org, and it only works on Windows, but this thing it's a flexible silicone rubber keyboard, and this really feels like something that looks neat to me because, you know, my keyboard doesn't always stay perfectly pristine.
Clean.
You know, I mean, and here you have this thing you can spill on it. It's made from, they say, quality silicone rubber.
Does it have springs and stuff in too, or is it just a squishiness? Like, does it feel like you're typing
you
on a pillow?
You can roll the thing up.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I mean, it's got a picture of it rolled up.
I'm just wondering if it
gotta
feels
ask.
Good.
It's kind of like watching the persistence of time, like, you know, clocks melted and stuff like that. It looks like a keyboard melting over the side of a...
It's surrealistic, yeah.
It definitely does.
The keyboard of Dada. But it's washable, dustproof, mildew and water resistant. It works on Windows 98, ME 2000, XP Vista.
Yeah, that's a keyboard.
It's just a really neat thing. I mean, a flexible rubber keyboard, you know.
Salvador Dali keyboard.
Somebody would have done this before.
Let me see it. It does look like Salvador Dali's keyboard.
Yeah, I mean, look at that thing.
Well, that picture in particular,
cool.
They rolled up.
The basic idea is you can jam it in your pocket and whatever, and then pull out a USB cable and flap it down, which would be really cool for, like, a device that used USB keyboard that was small and portable.
Yeah.
Without a keyboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
I had another interesting...
Yeah, another
just a mention. Quick mention. This is another device that I ran across. It's the cubicle doorbell.
Ding dong.
So, you know, normally when you go to a keyboard, or I mean, you go to a cubicle, mm-hmm. and you knock on the cubicle, it sounds like this. And, you know, it's not very effective. But so they have this, there's sort of a novelty, I guess, and it's a little thing that Velcros onto your cubicle and allows you to press the, you know.
And then it dings and dongs.
It has a number of sounds in there. It's got, you know, the old car horn, ding dong, doorbell, sprung, fading laser, knocking on door, fog horn, big band,
all
quack,
the default
quack.
Ring bells. Of
all the stuff that you normally see. It's got 12 different sounds.
Oh, that's nice.
But it's another one of those Dilbert-esque kind of geeky things that you'd have. And
Al, thank you for keeping us geeky and lighthearted. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Anybody have a great great podcast they've been listening to recently? Or
I really like this one called Geek Speak.
Self-promoting.
I have an interesting website.
Cool. Go ahead.
Hunch.com.
Okay.
And it's like a search engine, and it allows you to, you know, when you're looking for something, you like put TV, it asks you a series of questions. 50-inch or below 50-inch or mm-hmm. above 50-inch? You know, under $1,000, above, you know. And it asks you a series of questions, sort of like, you know, so when you search, it narrows down your search and it gathers all this information from other people and then gives you your search results. A lot of people are really getting into this thing.
That's cool.
It's called Hunch.com.
So that's for searching for a new product, basically?
It searches for anything. Just use the example of the TV.
Oh, cool.
But it's using a...
can you find news stories of that?
It's using collective knowledge for decision making, basically.
Cool. I'll look it up. Yeah. That'll be on geekspeak.org. Mm-hmm. Hunch.com.
Yeah.
Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by the University Advancing Technology, offering master's degree programs for geeks to become innovators of the future. UAT.edu/masters. This is GeekSpeak. We are taking calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are about technology, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll send those numbers out again in about 15 minutes after we cover this next topic, which I think is going to be engaging. Well, first, actually, let's do a little quick mention.
I have a quick mention because I'm actually pretty excited about this engaging topic that Miles had. I was going to cover it, but then Miles claimed it before the show.
Just do your story, dude.
Oh,
feel free.
Just do your story.
No. I just want to do this mention.
I knew better than to even try.
This is also pretty cool. So there's this widespread belief that the best clocks in the universe are what?
There'd be atomic.
No, pulsars.
Well, that's what they said. Oh, I see.
Yeah, pulsars in the entire universe, right? That's the widespread belief. And it turns out that that's not actually true. And that's because terrestrial clocks, it's clocks on Earth, the accuracy and stability of them have improved over an order of magnitude every decade in the last 60 years. So that's pretty ridiculous. It gives some specific accuracy measurement, which I don't know what
you
it
said
means.
Over the last decade,
a frequency stability. Over the last 60 years, every decade, it's increased by over an order of magnitude.
What year is your car, Lyle?
91.
Because that clock is totally not
that clock
right.
Is out.
And on the way here, it's
by 10 to the sixth less than.
That clock is 10 minutes fast, and it's a very effective way of.
Is that the right time? We're not going to make it.
You know, I spent about a month, this last month of GeekSpeak, I've been walking in when the show starts.
I know.
And today we actually were 20 minutes early. I felt pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm feeling less so now.
No, thanks to your clock.
Anyway, so pulsars, as we've discovered pulsars, we've found that their timing stability, well, hasn't really improved over the last 20 years because they're just pulsars. They are what they are. And so we found that the best millisecond pulsars have a stability of 1 part in 10 to the 15 is the frequency stability. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Whereas our clocks now, the best optical lattice neural atomic clocks, are 10 to the 17. Which
I'm
means
surprised.
That we have, to our best knowledge, we have the best clocks in the universe. Unless, of course, we're measuring clocks with...
We have the best croissants in the universe, too. It doesn't mean anything.
Who cares? Well, yeah.
Our general knowledge of the universe is pretty big. But what you're saying
true.
Is that it's been such that a pulsar, which is a orbiting orbiting
star.
A neutron star. I thought it was orbiting.
No, it's a neutron.
No. It's a spinning neutron star.
Spinning, that's right. Spinning.
So it's spinning
very
fast.
That it's rotation, and it actually spits out a jet of energy. And so every time the jet of energy hits us, we get a really stable
It's like a lighthouse. Yeah.
It's like a lighthouse.
Actually,
and it seems to be pretty stable. But, of course, it is. It's losing mass because it's shooting out energy. So I'm assuming it's not that stable.
Well, also, it's not just that it's speeding up as it loses mass or slowing down as it encounters friction or something. It's actually that it's just not. It's not actually accurate. Like, you look at this graph, and the line doesn't decrease or increase, doesn't have a curve to it. It actually kind of
it
has
varies.
A little woggle or wiggle. I'm not exactly sure why.
What is caused by? Gravity field.
There have got to be anomalies within the star itself. That, I mean, you know, if you're spinning on a swing and you're moving around, then the fact that you're moving your arms changes the rate of your spinning.
Are you saying there's something physically about the body?
Maybe. I'm just, you know, I don't know anything about neutron stars.
It also could be that space itself has a fluctuation from large gravitational waves, right? That's theoretically, so maybe that could affect the spin.
That's true. Actually, when pulsars were first discovered, we thought it was intelligent life because, so you know, it was like this flashlight on the sky, on, off, on, off, on, off, on,
right.
off.
It looked like a lighthouse.
Yeah, it was rhythmic. And so we thought, oh, well, maybe someone is just, you know, blasting energy in our direction in a rhythmic pulse to show that they're intelligent.
Right.
And then we found that, no, in fact, it's not. If you want to demonstrate your intelligence, then flash the first five prime numbers.
Yeah, and, the prime number thing is exactly what they do in Contact, the movie Contact.
Right. In a lot of First Contact.
Yeah, First Contact, the idea of the prime numbers would be the
First Contact?
Idea.
No, not the movie First Contact. In a lot of First Contact scenarios.
In a lot of good sci-fi fiction. With First Contact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually saw that on Star Trek just the other day.
Yeah, the first 20 prime numbers is the way to do it.
Our Voyager probes that were going out in Pioneer, they have plates that, you know, showing the first...
Yeah.
The first prime numbers, and also showing our number system and showing pi.
Right. The things that
we understand pi.
Now, I love pi.
Are prime numbers base indifferent?
Yes.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what I just said, Miles? Quickly.
Right. Because of our fingers and toes, we count in a base 10 system. In other words, after we get through 10 digits, we switch over and start shifting numbers over.
Meaning
the
you
left.
Go from 0 to 9, and once you get to 9, then you start with 1.
Right. So we have a 1's place, a 10's place, a 100's place. That's the idea.
But there's no natural reason why that should occur. It's merely because we have 10 fingers and toes,
we
and we
guess
chose that.
That's the reason it's that.
Right. But in computers, we use base 2, or computer has binary, so it's base 2, it's 1, 0, and then you shift over.
The thing that's interesting about that, Miles, is reason
0, 1.
Yeah, and so there's lots of different, you have an infinite number of base number systems. Mm-hmm. We are very common with hexadecimal and binary and decimal and oct.
Yeah.
If you're a web designer, then whenever you type in colors like pound FFCCDD, that's a hexadecimal color, and that's in base 16.
Right.
Zero.
The thing, the reason I say that it might not be the hands is that if you were to do a base system, we're a base 11 creature, because 0 does not take a digit. So you're actually an 11.
But it does, because we don't have a symbol for 10. We have a symbol for 0 through 9.
Our 10 digits are 0 through 9.
We have 10 distinct items.
Mm-hmm. Right, but our hands don't count very well that way.
Right, but that number system.
You have to ignore one.
Yeah.
That's all. Something Waz said to me when we were chatting. I was like, what? Oh, I see what you're saying. All right, well, let's move on to a little bit of news from Apple, the Beatles music company. No, that's not it. Apple, the computer company.
God, I'm just a harbinger of bad news today, aren't I? So,
jeez, Miles.
So Apple innovated and released something
Apple
new.
Apple has just released their 4.0 SDK. Software development kit. This is for people that are writing for the iPad, writing for... although the iPad 4.0 hasn't come out yet. This is for iPhones like the 3GS and the third generation iPod.
iPod touches, right.
So Apple provides a programming environment for people to program for their products.
Right. And there was an original clause in their SDK that said applications may only use documented APIs in the manner prescribed by Apple and may not use or call any private APIs. And that makes a lot of sense.
Here's an example of this. When the first SDK came out, they had no interface to use the microphone. I think it was the microphone. And so when Google came out with their voice-activated search, they had to use a non-standard call to actually do something that's not published in the SDK to get access to the microphone. I think it was the microphone that was the issue. Maybe it was location. But the first rev, the companies that were releasing stuff, they were kind of breaking the rule of the SDK. Mm-hmm. So you're saying so that clause has always been there.
But as far as Apple's concerned, I can totally understand that, because they have an app store. If they allow apps in there and they're using these APIs, that Apple may not just be locking it down. They may just be saying, we haven't finalized the API. We don't know if it's going to change. It's just we're trying to get it working.
They're dealing with things saying, you know, we have a certain amount of battery life. We have a certain amount of privacy features.
Right.
Things of that nature.
And so it hasn't been vetted yet. And so they don't want apps going in there. Then they break an API. They break an app that's in the app store and then have to deal with that. So I can understand that. They've changed the
What you're saying is if I do something, if I'm a developer and I think of a clever way to do it, then Apple updates the software, all of a sudden my application breaks because Apple didn't doing something.
For everyone that has that app on their phone, that breaks. They talk to the app developer. The app developer starts blaming Apple. It ends up being a very messy
Apple says,
situation.
Here's the baseline. Don't play outside the sandbox.
Right.
Okay.
And they enforce that by looking over the code and doing that. which I think is actually the impetus behind their recent change, where they're saying that applications must be originally written in Objective-C, C, C++, or JavaScript as executed by iPhone OS WebKit, the web engine,
okay,
the web browser. Because I think when they're reviewing software, they're doing a code review.
Right, it's hard to do.
And if an application is written in some random language, then you need to have someone who's an expert in that to be able to evaluate that code to make sure there isn't anything malicious going on, that it isn't doing some sort of spam.
So all the source code goes to Apple when you do a submit?
Well, with Objective-C, you're able to decompile. You're able to go back and see where all the trace points are and stuff like that. You're able to watch and have much better control over that everything is
I see why Apple would want that. What's the problem?
You can also see where things are linked. Like regard to C, C++, you can see which libraries are linked. You can see those points.
So, for example, every time somebody makes a call to the internet to do something, they use a library that Apple provides so they don't have to redefine how to do that communication. So this is a very common way of doing programming.
Right, right. But by saying that it must be originally written in Objective-C, C, C++,
or JavaScript,
has a chilling effect. One thing in particular, for example, with Adobe, they're releasing CS5 with Flash. The idea is that people who already are Flash developers, you make your Flash movie and then export to an Objective-C intermediary and then write that.
So you're saying that the new language in this basically says Adobe no and slaps them down.
Yes.
Yeah. And
just before Adobe announces the product.
Is Adobe
is that Flash wasn't allowed on the iPhone, and then Adobe pretty much put a bunch of manpower into developing this feature, which they're touting as pretty much the new feature in Flash CS5, which, by the way, is released on Monday. And this announcement happened on Thursday. So they gave them 4 days before they introduced CS5. And so Adobe made a way to take Flash applications and export them
for
Flash.
Let me guess that Apple is not going to accept anything made without the SDK 4 version.
Exactly.
So you can't just
do the thing. If you're not using their tools, they're saying it's not allowed.
So then you can't come up with your own programming and just force Apple to use it.
Well, no, that's not what it's saying.
Sell it for you.
You can't use your own programming and then convert to what they want and then sell it.
So the original language with which you write the program cannot be anything aside from those four languages.
Okay, so I think we have a basis of what the issue is, and I'll just summarize. Apple has an environment where they sell applications and a lot of developers, and they're saying to all the developers, you have to use our tool to compile. And, in fact, even though we didn't have a wording before, you can't submit an application unless it's built with our tools, effectively. And if it's done that way, then you will accept it. If it's not, we won't accept it. Adobe, in the middle ground, has been making its version of Flash to actually compile code that will run on the iPhone and would be able to be submitted to the library.
Would be a native app.
And Apple is going to say no right off the bat because it doesn't comply.
How are they going to know that it was converted?
That's the question.
Because any type of converted app is going to follow certain patterns.
So it's different.
So it's
but
different.
did Adobe say, hey, Apple, we're going to make a converter. Is that okay?
I mean, we don't know what happened in the background.
Apple's device. I mean, it's like...
No, that's the thing, though. It's not Apple's device. Apple has... Apple produced the device, and people purchase that device and then pay a subscription fee to use it on the airwaves. But it's my phone. And
here's the thing, though.
The App Store...
Apple Store is Apple's.
The App Store is Apple's. But Apple doesn't allow you to use anything but the App Store with that phone.
Yeah.
So they become a gatekeeper. So
I mean, I can't play... you know, 8-track tapes in my CD player?
No. That's not what it's saying, though. The thing is, this is...
What it's saying is, this kind of music on your CD player.
This is raising monopoly questions. This is a question of, forming a monopoly? On the contrary, a monopoly has to follow a different set of rules.
But you're claiming that the iPhone and the iPad is portable. I mean, monopoly would be if they were controlling all portable devices. Yeah. They're not. They have one device.
You don't have to buy their device. You can buy an Android, which works perfectly fine, or a Palm. You can use somebody else's device. And, you know, if it's Apple's device, they design the hardware and the software. You got to just make work on their...
I don't see this being... Except for a slap in the face to Adobe, I don't see this being very different from the general concept is you can't install stuff on this phone unless you go through us. That right there is a closed OS system, right, where you can't develop your own applications. Even though Apple says, hey, you can develop your own applications for this, you can't really. You have to play by the rules very specifically, and therefore it's restricted. And they've always been able to say no to people. And they have said no to people with their own reasoning.
Can I run an Apple device, an Apple application on an Android phone?
If someone writes a converter, I don't see Android
there's no problem, no. Yeah. No, you can run unsigned applications on Android devices.
So
there's a checkbox you uncheck.
So, Miles, the question is, I mean, Apple has very clearly done this because they want to be able to sell all the apps for this device they've made, right? They're making a lot of money off of selling applications.
And it's a quality control issue, too.
Maybe.
The quality control is done by testing the app. That's what they're doing as part of the vetting process. So they're saying they're not testing the app. They're saying they're going to check to see how you made the app in the first place.
And deny it based on...
Or they're saying it's too hard for us to test this. The question I have is...
Even if it's using completely published APIs.
Let's get rid of completely the Adobe Flash converting thing that we're talking about. Let's just go right off. I want to make a really fast algorithm to do something on the iPhone. And I want to use that little library that I've built myself. I mean, some of these libraries aren't actually built, I would assume, by Apple natively, right? They're done with C?
No, you can... Right. Yeah.
So you think everything that goes in the iPhone right now is done in Objective-C?
No, it was saying it has to be either Objective-C, C, or C++.
Okay, so it could be in C. I see. Well, what about Adobe just spitting it to C and then spitting it to – and then compiling it? I mean, isn't it
– I believe they are doing that as an intermediate step.
So Adobe just needs to be more clever about how they do it so that you can't tell that it was converted. Because if you can tell that it was converted, there's something different about it. That's the bottom line. You've got to be able to convert it so that there's nothing different about it.
That's a good point, Miles. If Adobe was doing it such that Apple couldn't tell, you sure that Apple doesn't want the source code when you submit? I bet you Apple wants the source code when you submit.
Actually, with C and C++ libraries, I'm not sure if that's the case. But Objective-C, it's very clear that you are using Objective-C.
Even after it's compiled?
Yeah, you can use it in runtime. Yeah. It's late binding.
Okay. Interesting.
It's a message passing.
So, Al, you don't see a problem with this?
Well, not really. I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me that they do have a quality control. People buy Apple products because they want a specific kind of product. I mean, you can look at a lot of other applications, other computer programs that come out that just, you know, you buy it because it has a thing, and then you try it doesn't work. You know, it's like Vista is a good example. Like, there's all this stuff in there, it just doesn't work on my machine. You know, I have a Vista machine, it just, like, I can't believe it. You know, they say it, here is the feature, but, you know, they don't have any kind of quality control on it. They don't know what it's running on. It's, you know, there's all sorts of things.
Right, but that's not the same. Let's say right now you're looking at Mozilla Firefox, which incidentally is not allowable on the App Store for various reasons. But you have Mozilla Firefox in front of you, and it was written in C++ for the most part. If it were written in Haskell, and function exactly the same with regard to the UI and all of its functionality, is that cause for it to be disallowed on a particular platform?
Right off the bat, it's built in C++. That's not allowed on the iPhone.
Yes, it is. C++ is. C++, and C++.
Okay, sorry. Okay, but let's use a different example that I think
But if they're testing for quality, why aren't they testing the app for quality rather than testing how did you make that app in the first place?
They're doing that because they want people to use their SDK. Why? Why does Apple care? Why does Apple not want it? I mean, the truth is the transparency in this is that Apple doesn't want Adobe compiling for the iPhone. Why?
And I believe it's a competitive issue. They don't want...
Why? It's not beneficial to Apple at all for them to use the SDK.
Actually, it isn't beneficial to Apple because with Flash... You are allowed to target not just the iPhone, but also the Android phone and others. You're able to do cross-platform development.
You're saying that specifically, you believe that Apple is doing this so that people develop in their environment, and therefore there are less applications in other environments. You're saying if you wrote an application in Flash, you compiled it, and it worked on the Android and it worked on iPhone, you would develop there, and then there'd be more applications in the
There would be fewer apps that are made so-called specifically for iPhone.
Right. So basically, with Apple doing this, it's taking the developers out of the Android market. Is that what you're saying?
It's not. I guess from Apple's point of view, it's not diluting the Apple market.
It's a pretty weak reason for them to potentially do this, to say, well, we want to try.
You're saying everybody would buy Flash and not use the Apple SDK.
The look and feel on Android is markedly different from the one on iPhone. If you're doing a cross-platform app, you're going to end up having it be either something that's in the middle or something that isn't following that. Mm-hmm. So, and if Apple wants to say, we want the UI guidelines to follow a certain thing.
They could do
or
that.
Or they could do that, but they're not. They're saying, we don't want anything that even approaches it. I believe that it is a form of overreach.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, what do you think? Give us a call. Let us know. 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 476-2800. That's in the 831 area code. Or call us toll free anywhere. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We're taking any kind of calls today, so please feel free to give us a ring. I think we've done enough on that. Shall we go to the next story? Ben, is it your turn? No, it's not
no,
your
it's
turn.
Al's turn.
It's Al's turn. Al?
I think I'll talk a little bit more about robots being Robot Week.
Sure.
This is sort of an interesting thing. It's a there are tails. These, you know, I thought, you know, I ran across the story about a robot tail that, you know, you can put on and you wear it like a fanny pack and you control how it wags and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's
I
like,
don't remember the story, but that sounds great.
I thought weird. That's a weird thing. And
yeah.
I thought that's interesting. I was reading. And then I think I find another one about a robot tail.
Can it do things that are effective, like hold coffee for
you? Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking at first it was just sort of a whim. And then, you know, I see the video and it shows the guy using this tail. And I thought, well, that's kind of the kind of goofy, weird thing that actually sometimes, you know, you look at kids now, they wear their pants, they're pulled halfway down to their knees and their underwear showing and all that kind of stuff. And you think, that doesn't seem like that could ever happen, but there it is. You're seeing it right now. This tail thing looks pretty cool because you can kind of do it. And I thought, but you got to control this tail and that's weird. And it's the tail I'm speaking of was called the Mood Tail. But there, then I thought, what else is there? And I find this other tail. It's called the Silly Fulin by Rojo Kuwakubo. And this tail, it same thing, hooks onto you like a fanny pack, but it has an accelerometer in it, and you actually learn to control it based on how you move. So the tail ends up working, you know, moving naturally. And it shows these people walking around the studio, and they're...
Does it help balance them?
Well, I imagine that would be part of it. But I, you know, they...
The important thing is it blue?
Yeah, it's got a bunch of servo motors in it, and they say with enough practice, small movements of your hips can control the tail. So you're controlling the tail based on your move. It's like an extension of your body.
Yeah.
So you have this like thing that's a tail. And
okay, the question is, when your cell phone rings, does it get out of your pocket for you and hand it to you?
That would be handy, or if you could swing from a tree with it or something.
Yeah.
But, you know,
it's just a fanny pack.
It's like a fanny pack, and it just was kind of, it's weird to watch these people walk around with these robot tails. You know, it's a little offbeat.
It's a little offbeat, I got to say.
So, anyhow.
All right. Ben, what's going on with Saturn?
Saturn's a pretty cool planet. It has rings, and they're beautiful. But aside from the rings, it also has two other features which many people note. One is, of course, the giant red storm, the big red spot on Saturn. And also, there is a gigantic hexagon shape that's encircling its north pole. And that has really, really befuddled scientists for
hexagon
a while.
Shape?
It's a huge hexagon. Each of the sides of the hexagon is as long as the Earth's diameter. It's this humongous, gigantic hexagon.
What is it, a cloud?
It's just a shape that we've observed in photographs, and we're not really sure what it is.
On the pole or on the surface?
Encircling the pole.
Okay.
Yeah, up at the top.
I think they better check their lens aperture opening.
It's a lens problem.
wait a second.
No.
What is it?
So we still don't quite know exactly why it happens, but we've observed this effect in fluid dynamics looking down in the centers of hurricanes. Occasionally you can actually find shapes, like geometric shapes, triangles,
or
hexagons.
So is it a resonance frequency?
They don't quite know the experiment.
Have an answer? You're just teasing us?
No. Well, okay. So we've recreated this hexagon in the lab, which is kind of...
Do they know how?
No. They know how to do it. They don't know why it happens. But they have a 30-liter cylinder of water. It's set on a slowly spinning table, and this kind of emulates the Saturn's atmosphere spinning because the planet rotates mm-hmm. and the atmosphere spins as well. And then inside of that tank, they put a small ring which spun faster than the cylinder spinning. And depending on how fast it spun, by altering that rate, they could generate various shapes. Like they say, they could create ovals, triangles, squares, hexagons, apparently.
Can you do an octagon?
I don't know.
Because if you do an octagon, you have to stop right there.
No, they didn't. They didn't mention the octagon, no. But
interesting. Just by spinning fluid, you can cause
just by spinning
straight
fluid.
Edges.
Yeah.
Well, I would have thought it was a giant edges. Bolt.
Yeah, it looks like it looks kind of like it looks kind of like a worn bolt, right?
Right.
Where the edges are slightly
the
rounded.
The end of the bolt or the nut.
The nut. It looks like a
So slightly round on the edges.
Slightly rounded on the edge. It kind of looks like it's been outside, standing up to weather and rain and stuff for like 20 years, but yeah, it's definitely hexagonal on Saturn, and we've made it in the lab, so it's kind of cool. We're beginning to research why that happens.
I think it's amazing. Fluid, that just moving fluid is so complex. We're like, we don't really know how it happens, but that's neat.
Fluid dynamics is crazy stuff.
It is.
It's
Thank
really
you.
Complex.
Thank you very much for that update in space. What's going up in the Palo Alto, Miles?
There's a lot of work being done in genetic research. And finding genes, isolating genes, for example, in stem cell development or the like, is a long affair. Trying to isolate, say, two genes already known to be involved in stem cell development, if you look, it'll take, you know, a lot of lab time and maybe a year, a couple of years. There's a computational feat that one researcher at Stanford has put forward, a computer scientist who has some biology training, where he has changed that from, instead of years, finding genes in a matter of milliseconds.
But not the physical aspect of it doing it. So they sequence the whole thing. They've already sequenced the...
Right.
Okay, so you've got the whole genome sequenced. And then from there, he can calculate milliseconds, or
trying to isolate a specific pair of genes, for example.
Uh-huh.
The brute force method takes a long time for people to go back through and try to find it.
Right.
But he was able to find patterns that they would only occur if these set of conditions were to occur. Like these two genes could only occur and express themselves if these other set of conditions were also true. And so that becomes a set of if-then statements, a whole bunch of things that whittle it down.
I guess the problem is I don't know how you do the isolation. So I don't know how complex that is. But what you're saying is it's very complex. And using mathematics? Using statistics?
Well, it's logic and math. I mean, that's what computer science is, but it's distilling it down to an algorithm to whittle down the choices.
What's the guy's name?
The guy's name is Debashish Sahu, and I'm sure that I'm saying his name wrong, so terribly sorry, Dr. Sahu.
Cool. Very cool. Thank you. You got an update on
I got a quick mention. Speaking of Palo Alto, there is an event that I'm going to, Super Happy Dev House 37. It's a software geeks get together and work on their projects, ask each other questions.
Why are you going then?
I'm going because I'm a geek. I mean, you know, why not? my friend Kate is probably going to bring this crazy cake. I'm actually going to try and get her on the show at some point.
Oh, his friend Kate is going.
Okay.
It makes sense now.
Yeah, we're mature. Yeah. So anyway, Super Happy Dev House is pretty cool. I've gone numerous times, and if you want to go.
And you can learn more about that at geekspeak.org.
Palantir offices.
GeekSpeak we're about to do Podcast of the Week.
And that's today.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. KOSP GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and it's used with permission.
Hi, everyone. This is Al Luckow with GeekSpeak's Crazy USB Device of the Week. Now, if you're like me, as soon as the weather starts warming up, you start thinking about new things to do. The first thing I want to do when that sun comes beating down, bowling. Yep, there's nothing like going down to the bowling alley on a hot day, putting on some of the just-used bowling shoes that are still warm, and then grabbing a bowling ball with your sweaty fingers. The way I see it, the only downside is when you have to leave. Well, I ran across a USB device that might help keep your bowling memories alive. It's the USB Bowling Ball Flash Drive. Now, this is a do-it-yourself chopper. I saw one on the web by Chris Spurgeon. Basically, you need a 16-pound bowling ball and a USB flash drive. But I tell you, if I had the time and the bucks, I'd be spending it making one of these. See the real thing from the link up at geekspeak.org.